Welcome everyone to the last Quantum Info seminar of this academic year. This week, really happy to welcome Lisa Hengley to join us to give a talk. So Lisa did her PhD in ETH and then is now a postdoc in TU Munich. And she's done some nice work in open quantum systems, quantum optics, quantum info. So please take it away.
Maybe I'll make that smaller. Maybe that's the easiest. Okay, so, well, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm happy to present here some recent work together with Robert Koenig on oscillator-to-oscillator codes. And I will first tell you what the motivation for this work was and what its message is. And then I will tell you what I mean by threshold and what GKP states or codes are, although probably some of you might know even better than I do. And then we will get to the definition of the actual oscillator to oscillator codes. And finally, I will present you our no-go theorem concerning these codes. Okay, so in the continuous variable setting, Gaussian operations kind of take the role of Clifford operations. Like, they're easy to implement usually, but they're not sufficient for universal quantum computation. And what is also known is that continuous variable quantum information cannot be protected against naturally occurring noise, actually not even against Gaussian noise, using Gaussian states and operations only. But then Noel, Girvin, and Young proposed some codes which encode one bosonic mode into several bosonic modes using a Gaussian encoding unitary, but with the help of non-Gaussian auxiliary states. So the only non-Gaussian ingredient in these codes are the auxiliary states, which are each in a one-mode Gottesman-Kittarff-Preskill or GKP state. And we will call these codes oscillator-to-oscillator codes. So we were wondering then whether these codes could be useful for quantum fault tolerance, in the sense that they have a threshold and therefore somehow circumvent these Gaussian no-go theorems. And we got to the conclusion that the codes that one gets actually do have some error suppression capability, as Noel, Girvin, and Young already showed in their work, but they do not have a threshold for physically meaningful encodings. So they're useful, but not as useful as one might have wished. Okay. So let us first have a look at qubit to qubit encodings. So the picture that you see here depicts a typical situation in quantum error correction where one has k qubits in a state row, which one wants to encode into n qubits using the encoding unitary U. And so the code space is a subspace of C2 tensor n of dimension 2 to the k. And after the encoding, the n qubits are subject to some physical noise process, which we assume here to be identical for every qubit. And after that, in order to get rid of the noise, we apply some recovery map R, which typically maps back to the code space. So the whole circuit that you see above can be summarized in the expression on the bottom, which is equivalent to the expression now appearing on the right-hand side, which corresponds to the picture that now appeared on the top on the right-hand side. And this equivalence is actually just due to the fact that the R maps back to the code space, because this means that the resulting state after decoding is the noiseless encoding of some k qubit state, but not necessarily rho anymore. Okay, so now this whole procedure, of course, is only useful if the noise strength of the resulting noise channel or the logical noise channel is smaller than the noise strength of the physical noise channel, because otherwise we could just leave rho unencoded. And here the noise strength can, for example, be measured by the diamond norm of the difference between the noise channel and the identity. Now,
sorry, I have a question on that slide.
Yeah.
So is there any assumption under here? I mean, I would think that the action on the ancillas would also depend on the noise at some level. Or is U dependent on the channels here, or?
You mean, well, U would also depend on the number of ancillas, yes, or?
Well, I'm just trying to understand. So if you apply some arbitrary channel to each qubit, then sure, there'll be some logical noise, but there'll also be some uncertainty as to the state of the ancillas, right? I mean, that will depend on the noise, right?
That would depend on the map R, right? Like if you ask it to map back to the code space, you basically also ask it to set the to be such that if you would revert encoding, that the ancillas would be set to the zero state.
Okay, I see. Okay, right. So this is a condition on R that it has to work this way.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, okay. Sorry, it's maybe not that explicitly stated, but we assume that this R as it maps, as we assume that it maps back to the code space, we assume that if you would revert the encoding of the resulting state, that the ancilla qubits would be set to zero again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. So it's always a code word, it just might not be the right one.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay, thanks.
So does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Okay. So then we can similarly also have a whole family of codes which are indexed by some set lambda, which for example corresponds to the number of physical qubits. And then each of these codes encodes k logical qubits and has a corresponding encoding unitary and a corresponding recovery map. And so if the n really corresponds to the number of physical qubits, then this just means that you change the number of auxiliary qubits. So we then say that such a family of codes has a threshold if we can make the logical noise strength arbitrarily small by adjusting the parameter n, given that the noise strength of the physical noise was below some threshold value delta zero bigger than zero. So now let's get to the second kind of encodings, namely qubits into bosonic modes. And here we have a look at the system of n bosonic modes, which live in the Hilbert space L2 of R tensor n. And we denote by QIPI quadratures, so the position and momentum operators corresponding to the ith mode. And we gather them in this vector R. So now the commutation relations can be written in terms of some matrix J, which is defined as given here. And also the displacement operators can be defined in terms of this vector of mode operators R and the matrix J. And these displacement operators translate the vector of mode operators R via conjugation by the amount xi in phase space. Now, if you have two such displacements, their combination is proportional to a displacement with respect to the sum of the corresponding vectors, which means that we can write the commutation relations of two displacements as given. And in particular, two displacements commute whenever the symplectic inner product of the corresponding vectors is an integer. And we also say that xi and eta are symplectical integral in that case. So now Gottes monkey type press kill or GKP codes are defined as follows. We take two n linearly independent vectors in R2n, which are pairwise symplectically integral. So we have two n commuting displacement operators. And now we set the code space to be the simultaneous plus one eigenspace of all of these displacements. And to be accurate, actually, the elements of this space are not states, but distributions. But for the purpose of this talk, I will just pretend that they are states. And I refer you to the paper by Usuina and De Bievre for a more rigorous treatment of these objects. So now the stabilizer group of this code, so the group of operators which leave the code state invariant, are therefore all the combinations of the displacements with respect to the XiJs. But as we have seen on the last slide, the combination of two displacements is proportional to a displacement with respect to the sum of the corresponding vectors. And therefore, the stabilizer group can also be described as the set of displacements with respect to integer linear combinations of the XiJs, or equivalently with respect to lattice vectors of the lattice L given here. So now this lattice has a dual, which is generated by the vectors eta j, such that their symplectic inner product with the xi k's is equal to one exactly when j equals k and zero otherwise. And with the help of this dual lattice, can now get a complete family of inequivalent logical operators are indexed by the set L per modulo L. And also the dimension of the code space is given by the square root of the relative volume, the unit cell of the lattice itself, and the unit cell of the dual lattice. Okay. So let us have a look at an example. And also you're, of course, allowed to ask questions at any point. And you can also tell me, maybe you know all of this very well. And I can also skip some parts, just let me know. So the standard example of a GKP code corresponds to one mode and the square lattice of spacing 2 times square root of pi. So the stabilizer displacements correspond to the lattice L, which is denoted by L1 in the picture and marked with dashed black lines. And the dual in this case is also a square lattice just with half of the spacing, and is marked blue in the picture. And the logical operators, which correspond to vectors in L per modulo L, are generated by the two given displacements, which act as logical poly X and Z on the code space, respectively. And also the dimension of this code is 2, because the volume of a unit cell of L1 is 4 pi, and that of its dual is pi, so dividing them and taking the square root gives 2. And this in particular means that with this code, we can encode one qubit into one mode. And also depicted in the picture is the Voronoi cell of the dual lattice, which will be relevant for decoding, and which is just a set of points closer to the origin than to any other point in the dual lattice. And this is marked with these blue edges around the origin. So now for error correction, let us again look at the general GKP code QGKP. And here in the circuit, we have as input a QDIT state psi, which you encode into a state psi bar in the code space. And we note that now this psi bar is stabilized by the displacements with respect to the vectors psi j. And we assume that we have IID noise for every mode, and that for a single mode, it is given by random Gaussian displacement noise with variance sigma squared. So the overall noise can then be described also by a displacement with respect to a 2n dimensional random vector, which is distributed according to a centered normal distribution with variance sigma squared. So now error correction proceeds as usual, by measuring the stabilizer operators in order to get the syndrome. And since in our case, the stabilizer operators are of the form exponential of I times some operator, measuring them amounts to measuring these operators modulo 2 pi. And then since these operators themselves are of the form 2 pi times the symplectic inner product of xi j and r, this actually means that we measured the symplectic inner product modulo 1. And now, if you recall that the generating vectors of the dual lattice eta k were defined exactly such that the symplectic inner product with the xi j's gives delta kj, we see that this just amounts to measuring the quadratures in R modulo the dual lattice. So what we get is a syndrome in the Voronoi cell of the dual lattice. Next one computes a correction vector from the syndrome according to your favorite strategy. And then one applies a displacement with respect to this correction vector. So the resulting or effective error is then the combination of the error itself with the correction displacement, which is proportional to a displacement with respect to the error vector plus the correction vector. And an important example, which is actually also the thing that we will consider throughout this talk, is for the choice of this vector C is the one that one gets with maximum likelihood error decoding, where one singles out the most likely error to have caused the syndrome given the error distribution. Okay, so now the following animation by my co-author Robert shows such a decoding process for the standard square lattice GKP code. And here we again see the lattice L with dashed black lines and the dual lattice in blue and the Voronoi cell marked with a blue square around the origin. So now assume that an error in the form of a random displacement with respect to the vector Y is applied. So then the first thing that we do is to measure the syndrome. And as we just have seen, this amounts to measuring the quadrature operators modulo the dual lattice. So what we get is a syndrome vector in the Voronoi cell. And then we compute the correction vector, for example, using maximum likelihood error decoding. And then we apply the corresponding displacements such that the residual or effective error after the correction corresponds now to this purple arrow. And now since this purple arrow does not correspond to a stabilizer displacement, we actually implement a logical error with this error correction procedure, and which is here a logical X. And more generally, we implement a logical error whenever the vector Y does not lie in the Voronoi cell of the dual lattice modulo the lattice. So whenever it does not point to one of the blue regions that are depicted here. And the reason for that is that we assume that we have a Gaussian distribution of the displacements, which means that small displacements are more likely than large displacements. And in particular, if we measure the syndrome S in the Voronoi cell, then the most likely scenario to have happened is that the actual error actually corresponds really to this syndrome vector S. So our decoder actually corrects for the syndrome. And whenever the actual error vector Y lies in one of these blue squares, then this correction results in having an effective error vector pointing to the center of this square, which means that it corresponds to a vector of the lattice, which means that it corresponds to a displacement, a stabilizer displacement, and therefore we have no logical error. So we see the probability of not implementing a logical error equals the probability of the error vector lying in the Voronoi cell of the dual lattice modulo the lattice. And this correction procedure is successful with high probability as long as the variance of the Gaussian distribution is small compared to the size of the Voronoi cell. Okay. Other questions so far? Okay, so then let us go to oscillator-to-oscillator codes. So oscillator-to-oscillator codes, as introduced by Noel, Girving, and Young, are defined as follows. We have k logical modes in a state psi, and n minus k auxiliary modes, each in the canonical one-mode GKP state. And this one-mode GKP state is a special case of a GKP code, which is stabilized by displacements with respect to a square lattice of spacing square root of 2 pi. And the dual of this lattice is actually just the lattice itself. So it has dimension 1, which means that it is not an actual stabilizer code because it cannot even encode 1 qubit. But it is rather a stabilizer state. Okay, so now an oscillator to oscillator code, which encodes k logical bosonic modes into n modes, is defined by a Gaussian encoding unitary US, which in turn is determined by a symplectic matrix S via its action on the mode operators. So let us have a closer look at this encoding unitary. So assume that US is a Gaussian unitary and S is the corresponding symplectic matrix. Then if US is passive, or we call US passive if it preserves the energy, and in that case the corresponding symplectic matrix is an orthogonal symplectic matrix. And the corresponding operations can be implemented using passive linear optics, and more precisely, actually only beam splitters and phase shifters. And these are typically readily available operations from linear optics. But more generally, any symplectic matrix S can be decomposed according to the Euler decomposition into two orthogonal symplectic matrices and a squeezing set. And this squeezing set is the product of one-mode squeezings, US set, which require nonlinear optics for implementation. And actually, the implementation gets even more challenging for higher values of set. And now we can measure the squeezing of the symplectic matrix by the maximum amount of squeezing required for any single mode, which is equal to the maximum symplectic eigenvalue of S. And as I have just explained, this measure in particular also measures how difficult or how challenging it is to implement the corresponding unitary US. Okay. So now for error correction, we note that the encoded state is now stabilized by the stabilizer displacements of the auxiliary modes or auxiliary GKP states, but transformed via the encoding unitary US. And for the noise, we assume the same as for the pure GKP case, namely IID Gaussian displacement noise. Now, error correction also proceeds similarly as before. Namely, we recall that for the pure GKP case, we measured the mode operators modulo the dual lattice in order to get the syndrome. And here we do the same, just that we only consider those mode operators corresponding to the auxiliary modes. More precisely, we have to look at their transformed version with respect to the encoding unitary US. And the dual lattice, as I said, in this case, is just equal to the lattice itself. And the other two points are actually just the same as in the case before. And here we focus, as I already said, on maximum likelihood error decoding, which singles out the most likely error to have caused the syndrome, given the error distribution. So now, as we have seen, these oscillator-to-oscillator codes have a purely Gaussian encoding unitary. The only non-Gaussian ingredient is the state of the auxiliary modes. So the question that now arises is, can these codes circumvent no-go theorems for Gaussian error correction? And so, as I mentioned in the beginning, Nogiling and Young were able to show that their codes actually do have some error mitigation capability. And to see this, we have a look at an example, namely the two-mode squeezing code. So this code is defined by an encoding unitary US, which they call TS of G, with a symplectic matrix which depends on some parameter G, which in turn determines the squeezing. And actually here the G is the cosine hyperbolic squared of some small g. So we are sure that the g itself is bigger than or equal to one. Okay, so now the graphic that you see here is by Nogiling and Young. And in A, you see the encoding followed by random Gaussian displacement noise with variance sigma squared. And the QIPI are the quadratures for the ith mode, and they are transformed according to the encoding, and then they pick up some additive error due to the error channel. And to get rid of this error, one then applies the decoding procedure depicted in B, which consists of first reverting the encoding and then modulo measuring the quadratures of the auxiliary mode. And here, we note that by the action of reverting the encoding, the auxiliary mode actually picks up some dependence on the error of the data mode. So then once the quadratures of the auxiliary mode are measured, they compute a correction according to a maximum likelihood estimation method, as they call it. And then the corresponding correction displacements are applied, yielding some efficient or effective error. And as they can show, this effective error channel is then again a random Gaussian displacement noise with a reduced variance sigma L compared to the original noise variance sigma. But this is only true for a specific choice of the parameter G, which diverges for sigma going to zero, which means that the required squeezing diverges for sigma going to zero. And also if one looks at using more auxiliary modes in a repetition version of this code, one does get on one hand a reduction of the order n, but also the squeezing diverges as n goes to infinity. So we already see that at least this family of codes is not a candidate for giving a threshold theorem if we just look at encodings which have a bounded amount of squeezing. And more generally, we can actually show that this is the case for every oscillator to oscillator code. And to see that, we studied the recoverability of these codes under random Gaussian displacement noise at maximum likelihood error decoding. And as in the qubit case, we are interested ultimately in the effective error channel, where here again, the recovery map is chosen such that we end up with the circuit on the right-hand side. And this effective error channel is now again a random displacement noise acting on the logical mode, and it can be described by the 2k dimensional random variable x, which corresponds to the displacement or the distribution of the displacement. So now for a fixed epsilon beginning at zero, we say that the decoding was successful if the resulting or logical error lies in an epsilon ball around zero in R2K. And now with that, our main result says that the decoding success probability is bounded from above by the probability mass with respect to a standard Gaussian of a ball around zero with radius depending on epsilon, the standard deviation sigma of the Gaussian noise, and the squeezing of the encoding unitary US. And so one thing to note here is that this upper bound does not depend on the number of physical modes. So one cannot hope to get rid of this bound by just using more auxiliary modes. And so here the squeezing, as we saw before, is given by the maximum symplectic eigenvalue of the symplectic matrix S, and it corresponds to the maximum amount of squeezing required for any mode when implementing the encoding unitary US. Excuse me. The consequence of our bound is that in order for the success probability to be high, this ball needs to be big enough in order to include a 2K dimensional centered normal vector, which has a norm close to square root of 2K with high probability. So this in turn means that squeezing needs to grow like square root of 2K or epsilon. And this of course diverges for epsilon going to zero. So we see that oscillator to oscillator codes do not exhibit a threshold for a physically meaningful, that is, bounded amount of squeezing. Okay, so another thing to mention here is that this result is established for maximum likelihood error decoding, as I said, which singles out the most likely error to have caused the syndrome given the error distribution. But we cannot exclude the possibility that other decoders, in particular the maximum likelihood error coset decoder, could yield better results. So, and the difference of the LAD decoder compared to what we looked at here is that it singles out the most likely error coset module stabilizer operations and not the most likely error itself. And this decoder could outperform our decoder, but it also involves coset probabilities, which are typically hard to compute. So to get this bound, we use the fact that we can map our problem to a purely classical estimation problem, which we call the partial informed unwrapping of modular reduced Gaussian vectors. And it will be clear in a second why we chose such a complicated name. And for the classical problem, we have some parameter delta bigger than zero, a vector x in Rn, which we split in a part A and a part B, and the covariance matrix sigma. And we denote by xb star the modulo reduced version of the b part of the vector. So now for a random vector x, which follows a centered normal distribution with covariance matrix sigma, the classical problem is as follows. Given the modulo reduced version of the b part of the vector, we want to output an estimate for the a part of the vector. And this is a variant of a well-studied classical estimation problem called informed unwrapping of modulo-reduced Gaussian vectors, where one aims to reconstruct a centered Gaussian random variable from its modulo-reduced version. And here the informed just corresponds to the decoder knowing the covariance matrix sigma. So the estimation strategy that is studied here, of course, corresponds to maximum likelihood error decoding, and it finds the most likely vector which fits the model reduced B part, and then one takes the A part of that vector to be the estimate of the actual A part. So now the following lemma tells us that the success probability of this classical problem, which is equal to the probability that the estimate is epsilon close to the actual value of XA, can be written in the given way, where V is the Voronoi cell of the degenerate lattice determined by sigma to the minus 1/2. The epsilon of zero is the closed epsilon ball around zero in RK, which can also be seen as an epsilon thickening along the first K directions. And delta Z and minus K corresponds to translations by lattice vectors with respect to an N minus K dimensional lattice with spacing delta. Now, this lemma can be readily applied to our original problem, because the success probability of the classical problem equals the success probability of the original problem if we set the parameters kn to 2k, 2n, the delta to square root of 2 pi, and the sigma to sigma squared s to the minus 1, where the s was the symplectic matrix corresponding to the encoding unitary us. So now this lemma tells us that in order to compute the success probability, we have to integrate a Gaussian density function over the union of displaced epsilon thickened degenerate Voronoi cells. So these Voronoi cells can be either seen as the intersection of uncountably many half spaces, or as the intersection of countably many sets bounded by surfaces defined by quadratic forms. But somehow neither of these options is very handy for the integration we wanted to perform. But luckily, we can also show that each of these Voronoi cells is bounded by a polytope of dimension n minus k. And for these polytopes, we can find an appropriate parametrization such that for a random vector x, following a centered normal distribution with variance sigma, the success probability of the classical problem is bounded by the sum of integrals given on the right-hand side, which now can be bounded using standard techniques. And so finding an appropriate parametrization might sound trivial, but that was actually one of the key steps, and it required more work than one might think. But anyhow, so once this technical problem is mastered, then one is left to bound these integrals in the sum. And here the blue part is the probability of XA lying in a shifted epsilon ball, given that XB equals Xi. And here the lambda hat is a function of the covariance sigma. And this now can be bounded by the probability with respect to a centered normal random variable with covariance matrix, which equals the Schur complement of the original covariance matrix. And now this in turn can be bounded by the same measure of a ball around zero by Anderson's inequality. And now, since the remaining part can be written as a single integral over a probability density function, which is of course bounded by one, we can actually bound the success probability itself by this Gaussian measure of a ball around zero. And as you see, this already looks very similar to the bound that I showed you in our main result. And actually getting there just requires small massages of this measure. Okay, so the conclusions are that oscillated oscillator codes require an unbounded amount of squeezing in the encoding unitary to get a threshold when maximum likelihood error decoding is used, but they may nevertheless be useful for error reduction as shown by Ngo, Biermann, and Yao. So thank you for your attention, and please, if you have questions, just ask.
Great, let's all thank Lisa for a really nice talk. I can open up for questions now.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess my question is kind of vague question, but how do we conceptualize squeezing as a resource? I mean, should we think of it, I mean, if you need infinite amount of squeezing, is that like, you know, saying, you know, as we increase the energy that we can
yes,
do better?
You could really say that an infinite amount of squeezing would require an infinite amount of energy that you put into it.
Right. But and I guess the question I want to ask, I mean, obviously, you know, more squeezing is harder, but how do we think of it as how much harder, right? Like, is it polynomially harder to get more squeezing, or is it exponentially harder?
That's actually a good question. I don't know. I mean, I could just guess. So I really don't know. I would have to check that.
I don't think it's a question with like a rigorous mathematical answer, right? It's a kind of a physics question, but.
No, but I mean, it's interesting in terms of like, could you get very high squeezing where then you would reach errors which are actually like negligible, or is it extremely hard to get close to high?
But that's right. Yeah.
So I would say that it gets. I would guess rather exponential, but I'm really not sure. So don't take my answer for granted.
I come from a quantum optics group. I don't really know how the lab works, but from my lay understanding of my experimental groupmates back then, I believe that there is the hard means a constant. Very hard means a constant. Impossible is also a constant, and these are small constants.
I think I didn't get that. Can you repeat? Like,
I believe that when they meant they have achieved very high squeezing, it's a really difficult result. It is a constant.
Yeah, so
the squeezing amount is a constant.
Yeah, okay. That's true. There's an upper, like at the moment, I know there is some they get up to 10 decibel or something, like it's an upper limit, but I'm not so sure
I mean, obviously any number that they have currently is a constant, but the question is how should we expect the achievable amount of squeezing to change with time, right? And I mean, and maybe the correct comparison here, given that we're talking about a trade-off with error correction, is, you know, how much harder is it to increase the amount of squeezing compared to decreasing kind of the basic physical error rate?
Right. I mean, to be
those
fair,
are both
like
things that you can do
also,
if you work hard enough.
Yeah, whether it will increase or scale, like the number of qubits or...
Yeah.
We can... Yeah, I hope we can ask someone who knows, but it seems to me something much harder to increase than scaling up a system.
Mm. Yeah, do you mean that at the moment, like with what they have, they would need a new method to get higher squeezing or...
Yes, but I myself have no understanding why it is so hard.
Yeah. I don't know. It would be interesting to hear from a from an experimentalist. I guess there's no experimentalist around.
No, not in this meeting, unfortunately. do you know if it's like, I imagine it's harder, like I know there's some like record for the amount of squeezing they've achieved, but I imagine it's much harder to do these things like on chip as well. And there must be, because I imagine these records are probably some like special experiment where they do this, but they're just trying to get really high squeezing.
I expect that as well, but I don't know whether actually that even... there are experiments that they conducted on chip. Do you know of any, or was that a question?
I definitely heard of some stuff, but I don't know. Like, I think it's kind of like you do all the squeezing to start, and then you can put something through some reconfigurable Gaussian circuit.
I think so. One thing is also, I think squeezing can correspond to different things in different contexts. Mm-hmm. So not always, if people talk about squeezing, they mean exactly the same. Like squeeze states are also not always the same in every context. But I have to admit that I don't know that. But I will for sure check that.
Any more questions?
Yeah.
Say, if you do not have the exact GKS state, you don't have a, like, instead of an exact oscillator.
You have an approximate one.
Right. Yeah. An approximate oscillator.
We didn't look at that question. We don't have like a trade-off of different parameters, like of, how I mean, you could describe the approximate chicken peak caused by some parameter which you like go to zero or infinity in order to get to the ideal one, but I'm probably would be interesting to have the trade-off, but I mean, somehow since it doesn't work with the ideal ones, it's maybe not the thing that we wanted to look at next.
Maybe it is easier to simulate because the original thing is also a little imperfect.
Yeah. You mean easier to simulate, maybe, but I mean you would probably, I mean you would get less good results for the error recovery, right? Because you already have an intrinsic error in your syndrome, so to say. Uh-huh. So that. So like with these GKP codes, with the one more GKP codes, it's also if you would choose some other GKP code, wouldn't make things better because like the one mode has the largest margin that you can then measure the quadratures, like you get square root of 2π. If you would take the standard GKP code, would only have a square root of pi, not square root of 2π. So.
Thanks.
Maybe one more question from me. So you the way you showed this kind of result is to map this this decoding problem to this classical problem, and then you were commenting about like the kind of actual the best strategy would be this like maximum likelihood coset thing. But is there can you map that to a classical problem? And is it just that it's like less well studied, or is it just like do you know what the mapping is?
You can also map that problem, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, we also looked at that, but somehow we didn't know how to proceed. Like, because Well, here we figured how to connect it to our noise cells, which is actually also what they do they also get the connection to our noise cells, like the probabilities, which is then easier because you don't have degeneracy and epsilon fragments and stuff. But in the case of coset probabilities, like things don't work out as we do it anymore, like from the beginning. So I wouldn't know how to proceed. Like I tried, not for very long, because at some point I decided that probably if I don't have a good idea, then let's just put this aside for the moment. But, yeah, I don't know how to do it then.
Okay, thanks. Interesting. Okay, so last chance for questions. Okay, well, let's all thank Lisa again for a really nice talk.
Thank you for your attention.